Here it comes, the latest people, trends, and news on sustainable living in and around our corner of the country. Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Spotlight on the Southwest. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Spotlight on the Southwest. And for this show, we are going to put a spotlight on the Southwest, but an even bigger spotlight on the globe, on the world. And we're going to be talking about one of the most important issues facing us, all of us, as citizens of the planet, water. So I am Gina Murphy Darling, and I thank you for listening and for being a part of Mrs. Green's world. And as always, I like to thank the people that help make the show possible and support our mission and vision, in particular, the supporter for this show, the Chapman Automotive Group. And they really are known in this community for doing their share and showing they care about the environment, about their employees, and about their community. In addition to selling award-winning fuel-efficient cars, which, of course, Mrs. Green happens to like, they support numerous nonprofits in ways that matter, and they make such a difference, both by supporting them financially and by sweat equity and volunteerism. They are high on my list of companies that we should all be looking at as role models. For information about them, please visit them at chapmantucson.com, or if you want to know anything else about them, you can always email Gina at Mrs. Green's World. So as I said, we are going to spend the next 30 minutes talking about our most precious resource and the thing without which there is no life. It's water. There isn't a close second from where I sit. So more specifically, we're going to talk about water policy, challenges, and solution. And I am beyond thrilled to have with me, finally in studio, welcoming the recognized expert, a recognized expert who's long overdue for her appearance on the show. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Sharon Megdahl. Sharon, welcome. It's so great to finally have you here.
I'm very happy to be here.
I don't know why it took so long, but you're here now. So let's not cogitate on that, Gina. We finally made it happen. And allow me to read all these wonderful things that I want to say about you so that people know why I'm so excited and why I'm so honored to have you here to share what you do know, some of what you know, like hours and hours and hours. Sharon is the director of the University of Arizona Water Resources Research Center, an extension and research unit in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Her work focuses on water policy and management, on which she writes and frequently speaks. She also holds these titles: Professor and Specialist Department, Soil, Water, and Environmental Science, CW and Modine Neely Endowed Professor, and Distinguished Outreach Professor. She serves as the director of the University of Arizona Water, Environmental, and Energy Solutions Program, which is funded by the University of Arizona Technology and Research Initiative Fund, TRIF. So there you have it. I've heard you speak many times. I've read things that you have written, and I'm always impressed and come away knowing not just things that I feel I should know, but things that really matter. So thank you for showing up here today and for showing up on the planet to do the work you're doing. And let's make it all about you. So I really do believe water is our most precious resource. I don't think I'm going to get any argument for you. We can't live without it. And we're hurting in areas of the world where there isn't enough. And we're hurting in areas of the world where there's too much and we don't know what to do with it. And it's flooding and devastation. And plus, you and I live in the desert. So there's a lot in that cocktail mix of what we have to do to talk about water. So why don't we start with an overview of your work as director of the University of Arizona Water Resources Research Center.
There's That's a lot bit in of that a sense. Mouthful. Yes. Yes.
Say that fast three
yes.
times.
So I think I have a great job because I get to worry about water, but also work on it in a constructive way in multiple dimensions. I have the opportunity to do what I would describe as applied research, real-world-based research, extension work, outreach engagement work with communities and people of all ages and all locations. And I have the opportunity to also educate our future leaders in the water field. And the Water Center, and that's just kind of my portfolio. The Water Center houses Arizona Project WET, Water Education for Teachers, which is just a stellar program for teachers and their K-12 students. We have programs dealing with the environment, dealing with water quality. It's not only a matter of how much, but it's also the quality of the water we deal with. And we are seen, and we've worked very hard to be seen as an accessible location for the community, not only the university community. So we host seminars, conference, all kinds of things to help inform the public, because every person is a water stakeholder. So we want every person to understand the water resources picture and situation. And so all that we do is really focused on helping people be better informed so that all of us can be part of improving our water management.
So, you know what happens when you do this long enough, what I'm doing 10 years, you start thinking in tweets in a good way. But water, every person is a water stakeholder. It's so important. And I wrote that down because that's one of the things we'll use to promote about the show. You said it. Every single one of us has a play in the game. I mean,
and big the deal. Importance of that and the play in that is that ultimately, in all parts of the world, some tough decisions have to be made and investments have to be made. And decision makers often base their decisions on their constituents. And so we all are decision influencers, whether or not we're an elected official or an appointed official. Every one of us has a role to play.
And more than ever before, we have to really find our roles and realize we're stakeholders. And whereas it might not have mattered 2 years ago to have your voice be heard, it matters now more and more and more every day. We'll talk a little bit about more later in the show. So from you have a local view, you have a regional view, a national view, an international view. What are some of the biggest challenges that we face as a global community when it comes to water?
So for those of us living in the United States, and this isn't even true for all of us, but most of us take good quality, reliable water 24/7 as a given.
Totally.
We take it
for
granted.
We don't even think about it. Flush the toilet, take a shower, brush your teeth, wash your, yeah.
Many of us only think about it and think about where does the water come from if it's not coming. If we turn on the faucet and it's not there. Many parts of the world, there is no access to clean water. There is no plumbing. There is no sanitation. And the numbers are astounding in that regard. And so for the UN and sustainable development goals, a lot of it is about sanitation and water.
And just access to clean water.
Just for basic living, and then also for food production. As our population grows, and it's projected to grow by billions, we have to provide more food for more people, more energy for more people. And the good news is, but this is part of the bad news, is that as incomes grow, we all want people to have higher standards of living. People's diets often change, and they move to more meat production, meat eating, and that production takes more water. Well, we want people to be able to have the kind of diets that we have here in the United States, but all that takes more water. So we have just some very basic needs and quality in parts of the world. And then we have issues of, you've already alluded to it, issues of flooding and weather extreme events and what to do with too much. And in our neck of the woods here, what to do with too little, because we're in year 17 now of a drought in the Colorado River Basin, and bringing it very close to home, the Colorado River supplies 40% of the water used within the state of Arizona.
And so, every time somebody says that, I get the chills, not in a good way, but it's like it's uncontrollable to think about that. And you think about the mega fires that are still burning and have been burning and burning and burning, and the devastation. It's not getting better in areas like this.
And everything is interrelated, because if you've read some of the articles about the recent fires, the terrible fires in California, part of the reason there was so much fuel for the fire was because they had such a wet winter there, and so much grew, and then it got so dry.
Which people don't think about that. Oh, look, we're getting a lot of rain. Isn't that great? Well, no, not when it gets hot and dry.
So we're all dealing with issues, whether it's too much, too little, water levels around coasts, water quality. Flint, Michigan is a great example. Things seem to be fine there. There was a change due to the water supply, and then you know, high levels of lead in the water. There have been spills in rivers, and so we shouldn't take it for granted, and we need to know where our water comes from.
You know, it's so serendipity lives really high in my life. And the other night, I wanted to watch something good, and what comes up in the, you know, scrolling down, but the Flint, the film. And I knew a lot about Flint, have interviewed people about it. But to see that film and how egregious the things that occurred, the ignoring, on. And I just sat there, of course, I am being honest, and thought, get ready, folks, because with the changes that are coming about, Flint, Michigan is going to be so yesterday.
Well, I do want to comfort your listeners some by
please
saying...
Please do. You'll be the balanced guest. Good. Go, Sharon.
That in most communities, water is well managed. And water managers' jobs are, you know, include making sure that the water is of good quality and reliable and the like. But things happen. And so that's why we have emergency programs and drought plans and things like that. But Flint was an unusual situation. Actually had some similarity to what happened in Tucson in the 90s. And we live here in Tucson, where if you change the supply of water to a different chemistry and different type, that can take gunk off of
the pipes
that otherwise wouldn't be a problem.
Yes.
And so, you know, I'm going to do a quick segue to another part of the world, but the state of Israel is known as a real leader in water supply desalination. Israeli water experts came to Tucson before they implemented their large-scale desalination program to learn about what happened here when we switched our water supply from groundwater to surface water. And so this idea of learning across boundaries, across the world, there's so much opportunity for that. And I feel fortunate that I've been able to be a bit of a, you know, have a bit role in some of that.
You do have a role. And what I have to remember, and thank you for reminding me on the air, I get it, is that there are really great, informed, intelligent, committed people around the globe connecting to make good things happen. What I was referring to is I'm very worried about the current situation at the EPA and the relaxing of a lot of the, you know, the oversight that we had that protects all of us. I'm from New Jersey, and I remember when you could smell the Hudson River before you could see it, and it got cleaned up. The Clean Water Act cleaned it up, and it has become, you know, a multi-million dollar recreational tourist place for families and people to go. So I am concerned. So that's more that I was referring to, not any assault on people that, like the Tucson Water Department, who are so committed to delivering us safe, reliable water every day.
Well, and we'll have to have an offline discussion about New Jersey, because I'm from New Jersey too. So we'll have to talk about that. But in fact, it is what you just brought up is related to this issue of the electorate, the public being informed, because not all regulations are bad, and the regulations we have for drinking water and discharge standards and the like are very, very important. And
for our health.
You know, I don't like making predictions, but I would predict that if there were proposals that significantly impacted some of those very basic water quality regulations, that there would be a lot of pushback from the public.
And the states. The states have jurisdiction. I mean, it's not, nobody's going to roll over and allow some of these things to happen. And that does give me hope. I have good days and bad days, and I want to have more good days, and you help me with putting that balance back.
Well, and the Flint situation was just so unique because it did have this situation of basically an administrator making a decision based on money that affected the water supply.
And that's
where you have to have a lot of people weighing in on those kinds of decisions.
Yes, at what cost? I have heard you, I believe, refer to wicked problems, wicked water problems. What do you mean when you say wicked water problems? I like that expression.
Yeah, I've been using it a lot lately. It's something that I heard about the first time at one of the conferences we host, an annual conference a couple years ago. And the idea of wicked problems goes back. There's writings on it that I frankly haven't had the time to look at. But more recently, people have brought it into the water sphere. And what the discussion of wicked problems is intended to do is point out that these are multidimensional issues that we're dealing with that don't have simple solutions. So we have to get beyond the idea, oh, well, we could just solve this if only. And so these are tough problems. They're multidimensional. They don't have simple solutions. Sometimes they're related to other issues, like in the Middle East. You might have technical water-related problems that you could deal with if you left it to the water people, but it's wrapped up in other bigger political issues.
Yes.
And so you really have to approach it as, what can you do to improve the situation? You can talk about solutions, but it's more like a pathway, because the whole solution set is not going to be just one thing that solves your problem. And I often say that if it were easy to solve the problems, we would have solved them.
Right, right. Even when people say, well, what about desalination? We have all that water in the ocean. And I delved into that and have been talking to my friend Jim Beiser more about it, who's, you know, been involved in some conversations. You just don't desalinate the ocean. It's not like the flip of a switch. Oh, yeah, let's bring that in and we'll be all kumbaya. I mean, it's, like you said, complex issues. So you are consistently optimistic and realistic. What are some of the solutions? Do you have, can you highlight some that you think we can get excited about and have hope for?
Well, and I have my pessimistic days too. You know, I often
that's good.
I often put that glass half full.
I'm
and
glad
half
today
empty.
Wasn't one of them.
No, I put the glass half full, half empty on some of my slides and say, on my optimistic days, I look at the half full part, and the pessimistic days, I focus on the half empty part. So it just depends upon how you wake up.
It's called being a human.
A given day. But first and foremost, and we often talk about the low-hanging fruit, we all can conserve. I mean, I don't think you can be in a room of people with businesses, with others, and say, do you have the, you know, is there room for you to conserve, no matter how efficient you already are? And most people will say, sure. I could do more. I don't use a lot of water at my home, but could I conserve some? Sure. So conservation is clearly in the solution set. But for many of these bigger, wicked water problems, conservation alone usually is not enough to get us
right,
there.
Right.
And the conservation, you know, is multidimensional itself. It's not simple. We sometimes don't have the information to say what is the best thing to do. But I have seen studies that for households, one of the best things to do is change out old toilets.
Yes.
Get rid of those
yes.
high consumption toilets.
We did it.
And
we did it.
I did it when I remodeled too.
Right.
And it's not even that expensive. And there are often rebates in communities.
City of
so
Tucson
far.
Water has rebates.
So conservation is one of the elements of the solution set. Another important element is reuse of water. And we know that here living in Tucson. But in California, that hasn't been a big component of the water portfolio. And so when they had the drought
on it,
and you know, they're now looking at how to be more sustainable going forward and not so susceptible to drought conditions, because it's so cheap for them to do this, they dump the treated wastewater into the ocean. But we know, living here in Tucson, where we're more or less landlocked, that that's a valuable resource. And we have been using it, particularly in our state, for turf irrigation, a little bit for agriculture. But the Department of Environmental Quality for the state of Arizona is now in the process of adopting rules for possible potable reuse for drinking water.
I know.
Like they do in Singapore with part of that.
Yes.
And other communities are looking at that. So make the best use of what we have. But I do want to make sure we don't forget to talk about the environment, because we have to remember that we have a limited, finite water supply. No new water is created. I often use a slide of the water cycle to remind people of that. We can change its quality, location, type of use, or whatever. So some of the things that we might think about doing, such as reuse, could take water away, let's say, from a river or stream where it's being discharged right now.
Right.
So we have to look at the whole picture, but reuse is certainly an important part of it. Technology such as desalination, which you already mentioned, should not be overlooked. Yes, it is energy intensive. Yes, we have to worry about fossil fuels being used to power it. But there have been instances where there's been a requirement for a renewable water supply, renewable energy, supply offset. And we know we have greater opportunities for solar and wind power, but not necessarily to directly fuel the plant because that may need 24/7 power that. And then the other big thing, and by the way, the energy requirement makes it more costly, but it's getting more competitive with some of the other water supplies that people are looking at. And the other thing is the brine. What do you do with the waste, the byproduct of that process?
Got it.
And if you're near the ocean or sea, you can desalinate that seawater. You can put it in the ocean. You can desalinate what we call brackish or salty groundwater, put it in the brine in the ocean. But when you're landlocked, you have to look at, do you deep inject it into an unused aquifer? Do you let it go for evaporation? These are big issues. And that's why we don't see it being deployed everywhere now. But it's part of what we have to look at. And then the other thing is exchanges and trades. And I'm not necessarily thinking of every single thing right now, here and now. But there are people who hold water supplies who are willing and able to kind of trade, lease, exchange. There are willing sellers. There are lots of issues associated with that. Nobody necessarily wants the water resources of their region being used by another region. But that is something that is increasingly being looked at as part of the solution
and,
set.
And when I read, I've had some people on the show about water and the real estate in deals. I remember one piece of an interview, and it was in a book, and I'm trying to think of my friend's name, Robert. He's at the law school at the U of A. Yes, Robert Glennon. Thank you, Robert, who talked about, you know, this huge property, high-end property somewhere in California, and the company that paid an enormous amount of money just for the water rights. They could care less about the real estate. They were buying it for the water rights. So it's been happening, I'm sure you're aware, for a very long time.
Right. And, you know, when you mentioned a big house, it made me think about mentioning something. I mentioned conservation, and I mentioned toilets. But the big user of water by many households is for outdoors. And anywhere from 40% to 60% of a community's water use might be for outdoor irrigation. And yes, there are benefits having trees around one's house and so forth. But for purely ornamental purposes, when I go around and I see islands of grass that I know are being irrigated with potable water supplies, they have no value to keeping a building cooler or anything.
You just
I say,
go,
oh, I need to talk to that person here and talk to them about that. And the other thing, you know, just mentioning kind of at the household level, rainwater harvesting, even in the desert, it works. We do get rain. Sometimes we get a lot of it in a short period of time, but harvesting what you can legally, it's not legal everywhere, and we talking about at large scales different from household, but rainwater
it's
harvesting.
It's amazing how much that you can do in Tucson, Arizona with rainwater harvesting.
Absolutely.
I mean, enough to contain, when we have the monsoons, you can be set for the year if you have big enough containers. I mean, I love the people that are working so hard on that. So there's a part of this that you referenced, and I wonder if you have an answer to this. Like I told you, I just got back from Ecuador, where you don't throw any toilet tissue down the toilets. Very, very water conscious. Most places we went did not have running water, let alone drinking water. We were so very aware of that, front and center, in another country. What is it going to take, or are we close to the people of our country realizing that it's not a right, it's a privilege, and we are so privileged? Water's free, basically. Let's face it, we're paying for infrastructure, that's all. What's it going to take? Are people going to become more and more activated and become aware and get involved in policy? What is going to take to make this crisis, like, wake up people?
Well, and you just used the word crisis, and that's the big question, whether it's going to take a crisis to activate people.
That will hit me at home.
For people to make the investments for the long term. people, again, people are spoiled. But even here within our state of Arizona and Utah and parts of New Mexico, the Navajo Nation is an example of a tribal community where I've heard the numbers 30 to 35% of the population there does not have running water. They have to truck water, store water, very expensive for them. And so, again, it comes back to what we started out talking about, is people being informed, knowing where their water is coming from, not taking it for granted, because we have tough decisions to make, whether it's worrying about floods and what you do to build barriers or whatever for sea level
rise,
or whether it's here because we're worrying in Arizona about trout, or we're worrying about the fact that we're relying more on Colorado River water. And regardless, you know, let's say it's going to be reliable, it's saltier. It's got more minerals in it. And at some point, we either have to do something to desalinate that higher mineral content water, or we're going to have pay more at our homes to replace water fixtures and so forth. So this whole thing of crisis management, which is an oxymoron, I mean, we want to avoid that. But I'm not all that optimistic that we'll be able to avoid that. And I think California is a good example. When California tried to enact conservation guidelines, it didn't do anything. But when it got bad enough that they put mandates, hard mandates in place with penalties, then people acted. And what amazed me about California is that the communities there were able to meet these 25 to 35% cutbacks without that much dislocation. Maybe some fields got, parks got green, I mean brown from green, but they were able to do it. So that suggests that there's lots of opportunity better management, more water conscious behavior, but it may take some kind of crisis to spur the decision makers into action. And it also it comes down a lot to economics. You mentioned water is almost free. We pay less for water and trash and environmental than we do for our cell phones, which are very important.
Very important.
I don't want to say they're not important.
I know they are, but I mean, there's a whole conversation we could have about that. And this is like blowing me away. We have 3 minutes left. That was the 3-minute warning. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. So I think, you know, I don't even know which question I want to ask last, but I think a good one, there's two, if we can get to it. There are barriers, because think of our aging infrastructure all over this country. There are tremendous costs to replacing that in a time when we're in, you know, bazillion-dollar deficits. And there are other problems with water scarcity and the need to supply water to a growing population. What are some of the biggest barriers? Are they cost? Is it public ignorance? Is it lack of leadership?
I think first let's start with the very basics. And the very, very basic is in the Southwest, many communities are in water scarce environments.
Not all.
You know, some live in mountains where there's lots of rain and so forth. So you have a scarcity of the resource relative to demand. And so the real challenge is, how can you kind of reallocate what you have? And that includes improving the quality, the investment for treatment. So I would say there are lots of barriers, and they vary by community. In every community, water, in a sense, it's not local because we're transporting it into our region. But if you talk about groundwater, I'll come back to another figure. Groundwater supplies 40% of Arizona's overall water supplies.
Yes.
That's more local. So it's going to take investing in the infrastructure to treat it, to deliver it, to possibly transport it. That's controversial. It's going to take people coming together and say, okay, are we going to look at this as a collective, like Arizona did when we got together to say, we're going to support the building of the Central Arizona Project. So it's all the things you could think of. Not everyone will be a problem in every area.
Right.
Collectively, we have to look at all those things.
And it's safe to say, for the final words, that your message clearly is, if it is to be, it's up to me. water, use it wisely. It starts with the personal journey and awareness and then taking it to other levels. Is that the Sharon response? You're smiling. That Jersey girl smile.
And just don't take it for granted.
And wrrc.arizona.edu is where you can find out more information. wrrc.arizona.edu. You can find out about my upcoming shows on my website. Two great shows coming up this week. Sharon, thanks.
Thank you.
Time flew. Make it a great green, water intentionally used week, everybody.